As I said, this is our first Mass here in the Shrine for the year 2025. It's not the first Mass of the Jubilee year 2025. The Jubilee year started a few days earlier, remember. But it is something to keep in mind that we're in this Jubilee year, and the time itself has a sacred quality to it. Anyone following the liturgy has a sense of that, but it should be even greater now that we're in a Jubilee year. Well, there's a lot, of course, going on in the liturgy. Since we're here at the beginning of 2025, and the first saints of the year are Saints Basil and Gregory, let's start with them. Actually, Saint Basil died on January 1st. So that's like a sign to start, at that time, I don't know what the calendar was when he died, and I don't know what the liturgical seasons were like at that time. I assume it was Christmas time then. Almost certainly. But anyway, it might not have been New Year's Day back then. Anyway, Basil and Gregory are signs to us of the newness that has been given to us in the coming of Christ. Yes, they lived 300 years afterward, but they lived in the time when the church, they lived in the 4th century. The 4th century is full of all these great saints, because it was in the 4th century that the church could finally emerge from its persecuted state and start to flower. And the families of Basil and Gregory are examples of this flowering. They both come from extraordinarily holy families. You might have seen this in the little description of their lives in the Annalen Way. Basil was one of 10 children, and of the 10, 5 of them are canonized saints. And their parents are canonized. So both of his parents and 4 of his siblings are canonized, and he himself is a doctor of the church. Basil was, he was just an extraordinary person in many ways, something like St. John Paul II. Big personality, magnetic personality, brilliant mind, deep, deep understanding of the faith, and just an enormous impact on people. That's why he's called the Great, because he's one of these standout figures. Well, then there's his good friend, Gregory Nazianzen, they call him. Same age, come from the same place, Cappadocia. And his parents are both canonized saints, and 2 of his siblings are saints. So we're talking about like a saint factory, this Cappadocia. Another Cappadocian saint is St. Gregory of Nyssa, who's a well-known theologian of the time. So these fathers of the church who arise at this flowering of holiness in the church are quite striking to us, because they show us what happens when people yield to the power of grace. It's a good thing to be reminded of as we start the year 2025, to start this Jubilee year, that when God is in charge, when grace is in charge, there's no limit to what can be done. God at work in his people. St. Basil, by the way, is acknowledged as the source of what we now consider the 4th Eucharistic prayer. It's a very beautiful prayer, not used very often. And part of the reason why it's not used often is because it has its own preface, so you can't use it when other prefaces are required, including today. So even though I've done this in the past, strictly speaking, we can't use the 4th Eucharistic prayer today because it's Christmas season and we use the Christmas preface. So his prayer can only be used in ordinary time. So anyway, that's a minor thing, I suppose. But it's interesting to note that a saint from the 4th century wrote a prayer that we are still using to this day. Okay, so that's the saints. Let's take a look at the liturgy now. You who are familiar with the liturgical seasons and their rhythms know that we've entered into the second stage of the Christmas season. The first stage is the clearest, the most clearly defined, that is the octave. So the octave goes from one solemnity to the next, from solemnity of Christmas to the solemnity of Mary, Mother of God, 8 days. After that, we have these 2 sections which are flexible. If the second section is long, the third one is short. If the second section is short, the third one is long. So the third section starts with Epiphany, which is going to be this Sunday, and it goes until the baptism, which happens to be the next Sunday this year. So that's 1 week. So the octave is a week, the third section is a week, and then there's this middle section, doesn't have a name, It's the days before Epiphany. And this year, it's 3 days, Thursday, Friday, Saturday. So we're in this middle section of the Christmas season. And we are continuing to read from the first letter of John and the Gospel of John. You might have noticed that we're picking up exactly where we left off on Tuesday, just 2 days ago, but it was last year. And so we're picking up exactly where we left off and continuing to read from these writings of John. John, in his epistle, first letter, speaks about the lie and the truth, and about the necessity of remaining in the truth, and he speaks about the relationship of the Father and the Son. A little bit deep, but if you ponder it a little bit, you can see what John is doing. He's guiding us into what has been revealed in the Christmas season, guiding us into this relationship with God that's now opened to us. We celebrated this yesterday, Solemnity of Mary, Mary, Mother of God, and the whole point of that feast is to say, if you recognize who her Son is, I mean, if you recognize that he's God, eternal Son of the Father, well, then you have to honor her as Mother of God. So this first reading brings back to our minds this relationship of the Father and the Son, because like John says, that whoever denies the Father and the Son is the Antichrist. Whoever denies the Son does not have the Father. But whoever confesses the Son has the Father as well. So he's opening to us the importance of relationship with the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, which we can't have unless we're baptized. We don't have it unless it's revealed to us and then bestowed upon us. In fact, it wasn't even known. I mean, people didn't even know the Father and the Son until the Son came into the world, until the Word was made flesh. Who knew that God had an eternal Son? That was impossible to even imagine. Who could ever come up with such a thing? But now that it's revealed, this is Epiphany, manifested, now that it's revealed, well, now this is the gift to us. And it's a crime to be robbed of that, to be denied of the relationship with the Father and the Son. That's why he's speaking about the Antichrist. Anyone who stands against the Son is standing against the Father too, and the whole gift of faith. So John is emphasizing, be firm in holding on to, or in remaining in this great gift. It's the gift that we receive at Christmas. When we turn to the gospel, it's surprising that Jesus is not part of this gospel. It's all about John and his mission, his testimony. This was clear from Tuesday's gospel, the prologue of St. John, where it was clear that the Word was with God from the beginning, and John was not the Word. The light was in the beginning. John was not the light, but he came to testify to the light. So John's testimony is essential, but it's a preparation. He's not the Word, he's the voice. He's not the light, he's a bearer of the light. He's a preparation for the coming of the light. And so it confuses the people. Well, who is this fellow? Who are you? They keep asking, who are you? What are you? What are you supposed to do with you? And John, to his credit, maintains very clearly the distinction between himself and his mission and the one who is to come. And this is his greatness. His greatness is that he doesn't put himself in the place of God. He won't step out of his God-given mission. That's why he's the greatest of the prophets, because he's entirely dedicated to being a prophet and not to being God, or not to being the Messiah. That's why he has such an enormous impact on people, because he's so fully who he is. He's so fully abandoned to the will of God for him that he can be an instrument of God. He's a voice. And he knows that by comparison to the one who is to come, he's basically nobody. I'm not even worthy to untie the strap of his sandal. Well, John the Baptist reminds us of how holiness works. Well, St. Basil the Great does too, but St. Basil is such a big figure, it's hard to distinguish the greatness and the humility that makes greatness possible. But this is always how it works. The great saints are the most humble. They get out of the way. They're willing to be who God made them to be, and not anybody else. They don't follow the standards of the world or of the family or the culture. They follow the Lord, and that's why they become so influential. So whether we're looking at John the Baptist or Gregory Nazianzen or Basil the Great or Gregory of Nyssa or any other saints, we see this same phenomenon. God, who has come into the world and who has giving himself to us, wants us to remain in him, God will do great things in those who are willing to submit to him. And it might not look great in the eyes of the world. It might not even be noticed. It might not even be noticed in the church. Some of the greatest saints weren't noticed at all in their lifetime. But that doesn't matter. What matters is to be at the service of the Word, to be at the service of the Lord, and let him be the one to establish his kingdom.